Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. I want to open by telling you about the segments that we will be talking about today. First, we'll be talking with my friend Scott Ray. He is a professor of Christian ethics and dean of the Faculty of Theology at Biola University. Now, Dr. Ray's interests are varied. Primarily, his interests are medical ethics, and he deals with the application of Christian ethics to medicine. But today, our conversation is going to be Christian ethics in the marketplace. In particular, we're going to be talking about a theology of work. Now, why a theology of work? Well, I'll talk about that in a little bit. But that paves the way, then, to the conversation of principled Christian entrepreneurship. We might be mistaken to think that there's only one way to do business as a Christian. There are many different methods, if you will, but they're core principles, principled entrepreneurship, which we can see Andreas Widmer developed this. Andreas is the founder and director of the Art and Carlyle Chioka Center for Entrepreneurship at the Catholic University of America's Bush School of Business. He's a former Swiss guard. He served under John Paul II. He's the author of the Pope and the President. But the reason why I want to talk about both these topics is when we talk about, firstly, a theology of labor, we are setting up a premise for why it's necessary to see work from God's perspective. And what that means is work was inherent to the divine plan before the fall. And I'm not inventing this, that's a biblical fact. When God creates Adam, God puts him in the garden and gives him a charge to till and to keep the garden. In fact, if you're reading Genesis 1 and 2, it becomes abundantly clear that he's given the charge to till and keep the garden, and only after that is he put to sleep and a bride is created for him from his rib. This great language of Scripture is effectively telling us that it is not good for a man to desire romance and marriage if he can't provide a living for himself. And that's something that we would do well to teach our sons as we're raising them, that the desire for that kind of commitment, intimacy, and therefore the call of marriage must be preceded by a man's capacity to undertake the prudential call of providence by God. Now, that paves the way, therefore, to a man's participation in the greater work of work, labor, in the grander economy of the common good and building up of community and society. One's work is significant to God. God cares about what we do. He cares about how we do it. He cares about why we do it, because he is the author of work itself. In fact, when we think about these words, the economy of salvation, if you've heard that before, economy comes from the Greek word oikonomia, and quite frankly, that oikos means house, and it means the work of the house, or just very frankly, the work. The work of God, God's work in salvation. Through the years, many people, and unfortunately modern society, have developed a horrendous concept that in order for an individual to fully please God, they have to become a monk, a priest, they have to become a missionary, a scripture scholar, and yes, I know that I am one such, but my labor, even now, involves so much more than just the proclamation of the gospel, even though that is the primary reason why I wake up and do what I do. God calls all of us to exercise our capacities of entrepreneurship. God calls all of us to exercise our capacities for grace, for the exercise of the material order, and that's what's called co-creation, that we are creating value within the created sphere. The majority of our waking hours will be at home and at work, and this work is critical to be enshrined in the Christian worldview of work being pleasing to God, even if we don't directly see it. I cannot stress this enough. Your work, the thing that brings your paycheck, the thing that provides food on the table, is sanctified by God, and he wants to use it to help make you and I saints. And if we can reorder and restructure ourselves that way, then every Christian is called to be both laborer and entrepreneur, both worker and co-creator. And I talk about this in the oncoming segments. Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Pisa. Our society tends to have a negative view of work. And this is unfortunately the result of many modern ideologies more than anything. But the truth is, the roots of it go far deeper. Joining me to have a conversation about this is Dr. Scott Ray. And he helps us explore the biblical and theological foundations of how we view our work in God's economy. Scott, thank you very much for joining us. How are you doing?
Oh, it's good to be with you guys, Marcus. Good to see you again.
Yeah,
glad to be back here.
I was excited to see you again, and I greatly enjoyed our conversation last year.
But too.
I also enjoyed the conversations you used to have with Al. And we've post-fall developed, especially with the Frankfurt School permeating the culture and changing the way we do education, we developed this burdensome view of work. And as if, A, work is a burden imposed by a certain class, by the elite. Secondly, that work doesn't have a transcendental meaning. And thirdly, because of that, we don't have a biblical worldview. We don't understand that work was inherent to God's plan. So I want to begin there by asking you to frame for us how we ought to be thinking about work despite the culture.
Yeah, well, those are three strikes and you're out that you've just described.
Yeah.
I go back to Genesis 1, and I think it's the main fundamental thing to point out is that work was ordained in Genesis 1 and 2, not in Genesis 3.
Yes.
And that's a really important difference.
Yep.
Because if it's ordained in Genesis 1 and 2, it's ordained prior to the general entrance of sin into the world, which means that though work was affected by the fall, the entrance of sin, I think it should be pointed out that, you know, God cursed the ground in Genesis 3. He did not curse work itself.
Mm.
So the environment in which work took place became more arduous and stressful. That's all true. But in Genesis 1 and 2, God ordained work as part of the dominion mandate for human beings. And because of that, work has intrinsic value.
Right.
Not just instrumental for all the other things that it accomplished, but work is a good thing for people to engage in, which is why the Bible has no real categories for things like retirement.
That's right.
Which I know really rubs some people the wrong way.
But it's true.
But you know, and I'm not, you know, to be honest, I'm not so sure about the, you know, getting a paycheck part. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're always obligated to work full time or to get, you know, paychecks. I would distinguish between work for compensation and work for contribution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are two different things. But in Genesis 1, God gives human beings five distinct imperatives to govern the dominion mandate.
Yep.
It's to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, rule over it, and subdue it.
Yep.
And we often mistakenly put the be fruitful and multiply together as referring to procreation.
Uh-huh.
And that's not the way it was intended. The be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth were intended to go together for procreation, but the be fruitful part has distinctly economic overtones, has vocational overtones to it. It's as though God is saying to Adam and Eve, be fruitful vocationally, be fruitful in terms of unlocking the wisdom that God has embedded into creation and put it to productive use. So that's the very first thing that God tells human beings is to be, has to do with economics and vocation. That be fruitful.
You bring up some really crucial paradigms that the believer must have. Now, this is going to come from a literacy of Scripture. We have to read the Word of God and to dive deeply into it to understand His plan. But when we do that, we see that there's a divine, like you mentioned, intrinsic value. You know, Tom Nelson in Work Matters, he basically says this, that there's an intrinsic value to our work, but it comes from us being co-creators with God. And that word might rub people the wrong way if we don't understand it. So
I'd put it, you know, maybe extremely junior partners in creation.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, the Bible is really clear that, you know, God continues to be at work, sustaining and maintaining His creation. And He has embedded His wisdom into His world. And through common grace and general revelation has given human beings the ability to unlock what He's embedded into creation.
Yeah.
And business and entrepreneurs and, you know, and companies are essentially the means by which God ordained for the wisdom that human beings unlock in creation being put to productive use. We have a good family friend who had a relationship with a Caltech engineering professor who had this great invention that had to do with purifying water, but he wanted to give it away. And my friend had the hardest time persuading him that the best way to get the product distributed into the marketplace and into people's use was actually to create a company to sell it so that people had a little skin in the game to buy it, to be able to. And if he just gave it away, he said, it will probably disappear
right
after a while, because people won't see the value of it unless they have to pay something.
That's
for
right.
it. Now,
value
the price they charged was not outrageous, but you know, it was enough to make people have some ownership in the investment that they're making in the product.
And that's why it's so crucial for us to understand that handouts are not the way God intended us to function and work. That there is there's certain principles here with this Malthusian way of viewing the world, both in terms of population but also the economy. We think everything's a zero-sum game, which is a lie.
That's a misreading of economics.
Yes.
Because, and I think for your listeners who may be not familiar with that term,
that just
means the size of the economic pie is fixed.
Uh-huh.
And if I get a bigger slice, then you get a smaller one.
Right.
And there's a necessary connection between economic winners and losers. And that, I think that's what politicians mean today when they say the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. What the subtext of that is that the rich are getting richer and causing the poor to become poor. And that is a zero-sum view of economic life, which I think was characteristic of the ancient world in which the Bible was written.
Right.
Which is why I think the Bible has such a negative view about wealth accumulation.
Right, right.
Because in the ancient world, there were so few morally legitimate means to become wealthy. You did it through theft or extortion or, you know, taxation, which was legalized extortion, or some sort of abuse of political power to gain wealth. And I think we misunderstand that in biblical times in the ancient world, there were no rags-to-riches stories.
Right.
You know, I mean, they were riches to rags stories.
Right,
that's true. But, you know, you were basically stuck in the economic, socioeconomic class in which you were born into. And that's why the Bible has virtually nothing to say about ambition economically. And I think that's part of the reason why Jesus made the statement that it's easier for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to go through the eye of a needle.
Uh-huh.
Not that there's anything intrinsically wrong with accumulating wealth, though that can be idolatrous. But it's because there were so few morally legitimate means to accumulate wealth in the ancient world. And it was widely assumed, and I think correctly in most cases, that if you were a wealthy person in the ancient world, you had done so by morally illegitimate means.
Right.
Now, and there were a handful of folks that followed Jesus who were people of means. So there were exceptions to that. But I think the general rule was just the opposite.
Right. And even within that system wherein the scriptures were written, the notion of value creation was still a fundamental principle. It would just take a long time for the market to develop to the way it is now, where value creation has never been easier.
That's correct. And I think this is, in the ancient world, a lot of economic life was value extracting.
Yes.
And this is what so troubles me about the demand on business to give back, because it's assumed that by the normal transactions of business, they are value extracting, not value adding. So they've got to give back in order to get the scales balanced correctly.
Right.
And I think that premise is just simply wrong.
Yep.
And I think that's a fault. Again, that's a misunderstanding of what business actually does. And I don't have a problem with companies doing other things socially that are considered, quote, socially responsible, as long as you don't minimize the normal conduct of their business being socially responsible.
Right.
If it wasn't, they wouldn't be making a profit.
That's right. If you're not serving a societal need, your business would have collapsed.
Yeah. Now, there are some needs that we don't want business to serve. You know, so I would not say that pornography
is
meeting a societal need.
Right.
So I would make a difference between, you know, making a profit and making what I would call an honest profit. So an honest profit would be one that where, you know, the use of your resources is actually effective, not just efficient.
My guest is Dr. Scott Ray. He's professor of Christian ethics at Biola University. Yes, there is a biblical theology to work. God has imbued our work with divinely, intrinsically given dignity. And we have to reclaim that if we are to operate within a rightful understanding of what work is. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Pete.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Dr. Scott Ray, Professor of Christian Ethics at Biola University. We're talking about a biblical theology of work and entrepreneurship. So, Scott, when we left off, we had just started touching on a biblical reclamation of the dignity of work and entrepreneurship. Like you were talking earlier, we have this horrible progressivist narrative that if you have a successful business, you have stolen from the poor, and so you owe a kind of moral debt to corporate social responsibility. But we also have to understand, your work, if virtuous, is by itself a corporate social responsibility.
That's correct. I think it actually goes even further theologically, where Paul describes in Colossians 3, in a text that we forget the context, that was written to household servants,
right,
who did arguably the most mind-numbing, tedious, meaningless grunt work you can imagine. But Paul says to them, in whatever you do, do your work heartily as unto the Lord. And in, I think, parentheses, in whatever you do, it's the Lord Christ whom you are serving in the work itself. And this is why I often ask business people, tell me about your ministry in the workplace. And they will say a lot of things that I would categorize sort of as church stuff.
Right.
They talk to their coworkers about their faith or pray for them when they're struggling. You know, maybe if some companies, it's getting harder to do, have a Bible study at work, something like that. And they'll list several of these things, and I'll point out to them that what you're describing are all those things that you are doing when you are not doing your job.
Right.
And we somehow see our work as sort of incidental to our ministry in the workplace, when our work is actually central to that and crucial to our understanding of what it means to serve Christ. Now, that's not all of our service to Christ. I've never had anybody say to me, I work my 40, 50 hours a week, I'm done with my service obligations. Nobody's ever said that to me.
Nor should they.
Nor should they. We have multiple arenas of service, vocations, to which we are called all at the same time.
Yeah.
I've got a vocation as a husband, and a father, a professor, neighbor, church member, and so on. But I think that what Paul teaching in Colossians, I think, gives us really clear biblical warrant for saying that the very work you do is part of your service to Christ, and therefore has eternal value. And I don't know too many business people who get that about the very work that they do.
Right. And so when we think about theologically thinking about entrepreneurship, like you mentioned, we seem to think that there's an overt separation between the faith life we live and working the market. And so I think it's not uncommon to see people of tremendous faith not wanting to exercise the spirit of entrepreneurship, but that stands contradictory to being bearers of the divine image.
Oh, I think that's quite contrary to that, because God has endowed human beings with certain entrepreneurial traits. Now, they're stronger with some than others.
Yep.
But I think, God himself exercised entrepreneurial traits in creation.
Right.
With innovation and creativity and things that we value in entrepreneurs today. So I think there's a lot of merit to that. And I'd want to emphasize, too, to your audience that given the amount of time that people spend in the workplace as opposed to the number of hours they spend in a church building, wouldn't we expect that the workplace might be the primary crucible in which God shapes men and women spiritually?
Right.
Maybe just by virtue of that number of hours spent, that might be the primary place that we fulfill the mandate to love our neighbor.
Uh-huh. I'm reminded of, again, Nelson, Why Work Matters. He talks about how if on Sunday we do the work of worship and we are there taught by the scriptures that all our work is a kind of worship to God, then is there a substantive difference between what we do on Sunday and what we do on Monday?
Probably not, although I would want to say, although we're clearly hardwired for work.
Yeah.
As part of our spiritual DNA, as the late Chuck Olson put it.
Yeah.
But I say we're also hardwired for Sabbath, too.
Yes.
And part of that is because, our bodies simply need that. But it also is God's way of preventing our work from becoming a source of our identity and becoming idolatrous for us.
Right.
And so even though I'm not convinced that the Sabbath command in the Mosaic Law is enforced in the same way that it was in Old Testament Israel, but at the least it is surely a really good idea to maintain today.
Right. And we've lost sight of it. It's not uncommon, once again, to see even people of faith talking about having to work virtually a full day sometimes on Sunday. And we often forget that all of our work throughout the week ought to lead to the grandest work we do, which is Sunday worship.
Correct. And the term, actually the term for work that's used in Genesis, the term avodah,
yes,
is also translated as worship.
Yes.
Okay. Now I'm not I wouldn't want to equate work and worship. Those are two distinct things.
Yep.
But the carryover there, I think, is intentional in the scriptures.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And so in your book, The Business of the Common Good, you you talk about how you can see Christian business as a mission. And if you start seeing it that way, then you're seeing that there's a heavenly telos to every day when you clock in, because you're not just clocking in, you're invested in a mission for the sake of the common good.
That's correct. And the fact that most legitimate business it makes a valuable contribution to human shalom.
Yes.
The best way I know to translate that is human flourishing.
Mm.
And I think, Marcus, one of the places where our churches need to do a better job is explaining to people how the work that they do in their various occupations contributes to the flourishing of individuals, families, and communities.
Right.
I mean, even sort of technical things like auditing a company's books, contributes to the building of trust.
Yep.
In our economic system, trust in a company's financial statements.
Right.
And that, as you know, that sort of trust and disclosure and transparency is just a part and parcel of properly functioning market systems.
Right.
And it goes, think about how communities and families would flourish if we didn't have plumbers.
Right.
Or auto mechanics. Because this is not just a white collar thing. It's every occupation that has a legitimate purpose. Now there's some I'm going to exclude from that. I'm still waiting for somebody to tell me that God's calling me to be a Playboy photographer. Probably not.
Right.
But I think that's a really important task for those priests and pastors who listen to you, to help their people have their antenna up.
Yep.
In the workplace, through their workplace interactions, to be better aware of how God is shaping and molding them spiritually. Because
right.
I do think that, not to minimize what goes on inside the church building, but that's not the front lines.
Yes.
The front lines is what happens when people leave the building and go out into the world to do what God's calling them in their various arenas of service.
And that's precisely why we shouldn't wait for centralized government to regulate our virtue ethics in business. We ought to be operating from a higher principle, which is the faith that we receive within the church building.
Well, and I actually think that the amount of virtue necessary to run a properly functioning market system is widely underestimated.
Yes.
I'll give you an example. I had a student of mine who came to Talbot from Ethiopia. He'd never been outside his village. And, this is the first time, first time he walked into our dining hall, he was just completely overwhelmed by the amount of choices and food that was available. But the second day he was on campus, I took him out for lunch and paid for lunch with a credit card. He had never seen a credit card before. And I'm sure he wondered, what on earth is going on? My ethics professor is stealing our lunch. Because he didn't understand that American Express trusts me to pay the bill within 30 days, and the restaurant trusts American Express to pay them the bill.
Uh-huh.
All he saw was this transaction. So when I explained it to him, he said, oh my gosh, that would never happen in my community. In fact, what he described is that in lots of cases in their communities, somebody would have the good in one hand and the other person would have the money in the other, and they'd both swap right at the same time.
So that no one's stealing from the other.
Right. And so I said, dude, your transaction costs are off the charts. And it's no wonder that you've had poor economic development for so many years,
right,
because nobody trusts each other.
Right.
And that's the genius of Christianity in terms of the economic sphere, because by virtue of people worshiping together and having a common bond in their faith, they trusted people who were outside of blood family members, which was so far outside the norm historically. But that was a crucial part of economic systems beginning to flourish and function like they are today.
Right. Scott, real joy. Thank you for making the time.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Scott Ray, Professor of Christian Ethics at Biola University, and we've been talking about a virtuous Christian biblical framework for work, business, and entrepreneurship. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome back.
I'm Marcus Peter. The question about engaging in enterprise is an interesting one because a lot of people think that there might be only one way to do business in the Christian premise, but the truth is if we practice virtuous principled entrepreneurship, well, one approach that puts the human person in full flourishing puts the human person at the center, applying a Christian anthropology, promoting excellence in human flourishing without foregoing profitability. Joining me to talk about this is my friend Andreas Wittmer, founder and director of the Art and Carlyle Chioka Center of Entrepreneurship at the Catholic University of America. Andreas, how are you doing? Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I want to begin with this notion of what entrepreneurship ought to look like. Now, this comes directly from your book, I understand.
Yeah.
But even in your course and in a proper way of thinking about entrepreneurship and the work of the human person, this language of co-creatorship means that principles undergird the enterprise of being an entrepreneur. You see a need, you seek to fill a need for the right reasons. I'd like to begin there.
So the co-creation, the principle idea, I had this great privilege in my life to have known St. John Paul II. I served him in the Swiss Guards.
Yep.
And he has, of course, influenced my life tremendously. It's not like that I had like these sit-down dinners with him or something, but you're always in the room when he talks,
uh-huh.
And that affects you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One of the things he talked a lot about in the 80s, well, he talked about a lot during his life, is this what he called the theology of the body. So much of what I do today is inspired by him, and I apply the theology of the body to business.
Uh-huh.
Now, specifically, the way this works in this idea of co-creation is that he would explain that when God created man, man is the first animal that he created where he said, I want to create somebody in my image,
right,
and likeness, and not before God created all these animals and would like create, take clay and form them, and off they go. And a beautiful image. John Paul would have fun describing the creativity of God there. And the creativity of the Trinity, which this is a discussion, this is an idea, and then it's realized and into reality, into the physical reality, until God said, let us make somebody in our image and likeness.
Right.
And what did he do? He takes again the clay and builds us exactly like the animal. So we're exactly like the animal, except at the end, he breathes his spirit into us.
Right.
Didn't do that to the animals. So when he breathed the spirit into us, he takes us aside and he says, you are now my representative down here. You continue the stewardship mandate. You now continue the work I have begun of creation. So you're my representative. You continue creation, and we will call that work. So what we do when... I don't care if you're listening to this and you're cooking a meal right now. If you're cleaning the floor, if you make a bed, or if you run a $100 million company, you are continuing creation,
yeah,
by what you do physically. That is one of the core understandings that we have to have of work, that per se in the beginning, when I do this work, I clean a room, I create order, that's like God saying, let there be light.
Right.
And you're doing that, again, with an understanding and then executing this. It's so important to understand that this is what work is all about. This contrasts a lot with what we do today,
mm-hmm,
and how we look at work today. Every theory of work or business today only looks at the outcome.
That's right, utilitarian.
And Catholic understanding of work doesn't just do that. Of course there's an outcome, but it looks at the work path itself. Work itself has to be holy. And it is when we work in a way where we imitate God, where we continue God's creation,
mm-hmm,
in imitation of him. Because when you imitate somebody, you become more like them.
Right.
And how is God? God is holy. When we work to create goods that are truly good, services that truly serve, then we imitate God, who, by the way, every evening said, and he saw that it was good.
Yep.
Right? And if we do this, if we work like that, we become more like God, and that is part of our path to holiness.
Right.
I'd say this is one of the key things that John Paul taught. That is forgotten today. Our culture doesn't do this, but it would fit very well. You don't have to change anything else. It would fit into our system very well. And that is the core of principled entrepreneurship. And from there, then, I go, okay, that means there's certain pillars along this. And I have five pillars that I describe on that. I'm sorry this is a long description, but it's one of these things that people don't understand what the Catholic view of work is. Why would the Church say there is a right to work? Because it's part of our path to holiness. But the Church also says there's a duty,
yes,
to work. because it is a part of our path to holiness. But there's a lot of misunderstandings out there, and I think we have a long way to go to really explain that to our community.
We've seen a great permeation of these anti-Christian, frankly, anti-Christian mm-hmm. ideologies about the notion of work. You see some origins of this strain of thought in Das Kapital, and then eventually, you know, Engels in some of his ancillary writings, right? But then the Frankfurt School really picks it up mm-hmm. and then makes sure that it gets proliferated subtly. Yeah. And so now work is seen as this oppressive thing. That's the narrative, that work is this yeah. oppressive thing, that especially if you are part of this class that has to work, it's this burden placed yeah. on you. And it robs it of its sanctifying dignity.
To me, that's the overall issue. That's what I would actually call the Marx, this kind of Marxism. Marx introduced, maybe he was not the first one, but he introduced this either or, like yes. to say, is this or that,
yeah.
and capital and labor, and one has to win, and it's an existential fight to the yeah. end. That is not how God created the world. There will never be a time where capital doesn't need labor and labor doesn't need capital, no matter, by the way, what they say about AI and anything like that. God made us complementary. Yeah. Men need women, women need men, adults need children, children need adults. You know, he made us complementary, and in that sense, fruitful. The fruitful yeah. comes when complementary comes together. That's one of the things that Marx then denies. And that's where identity politics comes in, that's where this labor versus capital comes in. And I'm not faulting one particular side. I'm saying anybody who looks at the world in this vision of either or, us versus them, is missing the point
yes.
of how God actually made the world.
And so when I go back to your book, The Art of Principled Entrepreneurship, very early on in the book you make it very clear that the principled entrepreneur seeks out and pursues excellence at the service of others.
Mm.
Andreas, just that one sentence alone sounds tremendously alien to a post-Christian materialist yeah. worldview, which is how we do business today.
Yeah. I can, of course, extrapolate. It's funny, when you work, you get the luxury, you get the privilege to say a loaded sentence like that and get away with it, right? Because nobody can say, hey, explain. But let me explain. What I mean by that is that when we work, let me take a step back for a uh-huh. second. Say the sentence again.
Oh, sure. The principled entrepreneur yeah. places himself at the pursuit of excellence yeah. for the service
so
of others.
When you hear how I'm saying this, you place yourself between two things. You place yourself on the value line, in a way, of a product that's being created or a good
uh-huh.
or a service that's being created, and your personal excellence. Business is fundamentally a question that says, how may I help you? So I ask you if I can use my talent, my God-given talent, hopefully something innate, something I'm just good at or I have a proclivity to,
yeah, yeah.
I can create value for you. I do something, I cook eggs, I can clean, I can do all kinds of things where you find it represents a value to you. Usually you actually find it more valuable in number than it costs me to supply it.
That's right.
The difference of that, I don't call the difference of that profit. I call that newly created value.
That's right.
And therefore, it's new money.
Right. That's wealth that's been created.
It's new wealth. If we do it like this, where I create value for others, then money is actually one of the few unlimited resources we have.
Right.
Yet, the world thinks it's a limited resource.
Right.
Right? And so, this whole idea of the, if I do this, I create value for you, but if I use my God-given talents and create that value, I actually grow in God's plan for me, because
right.
I'm doing the talents, the parable of the talents is being lived out,
uh-huh.
that I'm using my talent, I invest it in Lord, the Lord looks for a return, namely that profitability. And I think that's a deeply beautiful meditation that uh-huh. we can do on the parable of the talents.
Right.
And apply that to our work.
Right.
It requires, that sentence, how may I help you, has everything in it that's needed for good business. It's you, it's me, and the help I create for you. It's total other directedness. And by giving like that, I actually grow in my own holiness.
Right.
It's the perfect equation.
And you're mirroring the brilliance of Sir John Paul Laborn's Exercens, but then eventually we'll also see that thought comes out in Caritas in Veritate, particularly about work, drawing a kind of sanctification for the worker, even in the face of poverty, it creates meaning and purpose. I'm talking with Andreas Wittner of the Catholic University of America, director of the Art and Carlyle Chioka Center. Continuing this conversation on the other side of the break, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with Andreas Wittmann, no stranger to this program. We're talking about principled entrepreneurship, creativity, and faith and work and culture. So, Andreas, you were talking earlier about how work has this amazing capacity to sanctify us because it allows us to participate in God's own creativity. You also, in your book, The Art of the Principled Entrepreneur, then go on to say this: wealth is not a zero-sum game. We treat wealth and resources, especially Ehrlich, you know, yeah. Ehrlich and this Malthusian thought, exactly, as if wealth and resources are zero-sum and human beings are parasites.
Yeah.
And it's such a misanthropic, destructive worldview.
It's not just that, it's a lie.
Yes.
And you know where lies come from. This is a very horrible lie that's there. Because that is, John Paul once talked about this and said, first of all, he objected to the idea to measure a human being by money. So, because the normal measure of poverty is to say, it's whatever they say, $1, right, $2 a day, and then you're poor.
Right.
And he says, that's just, first of all, that's a demeaning way to measure somebody. And second of all, it's not a good measure in the first place, he says, because it begs the answer already. It has the answer in it already. It is a foregone conclusion because it represents it as if money was a finite resource.
Right.
And he called it an imagined finite resource, money. And therefore, the solution to, if I have, you know, $2 and you have $10, the just solution is for you to give me some of your money. But that's where this light goes with that problem statement.
Right, right, right.
The truth is that money is, of course, a transfer value.
Yes.
And if I work and create something and in a way sell it or sell the work that I'm doing, I can create new money all the time.
Right, right, right.
The solution to poverty, therefore, is not the, quote, redistribution of wealth, but it is actually the creation of wealth.
Yes.
And as long as our focus of governments and society and the church to some extent is on the redistribution on wealth, we will never actually achieve prosperity because we're not unleashing the one investment in the world that has infinite return, which is the human being.
Yep. Thomas Sowell, in Basic Economics, he talks about how this notion, first of all, the fundamental principle of economics is scarcity. There's always a need that needs to be filled, right? But then he also goes on to say this, and it's so practical, we can't distribute if we don't first create.
That's the fallacy of this, that it's a hole that you go into. It's like Art Sioka that I'm writing about in The Principle of Entrepreneurship. The last principle is always think like an entrepreneur. And in it, he says in a way this his own parable, where he says, in life, and especially in agriculture, he was in wine, in the vineyard I have found two kinds of people only, creators and harvesters. And there's the harvesters to come in that just pillage the vineyard and just grab everything and then walk away and not show up until the next harvest. The creator will also harvest, but they stay with the vineyard and they create and they toil the soil and they make and they clip and they invest in the vineyard, which then will actually increase and give more, and they will be successful over the long term. The harvesters will actually destroy the vineyard in one ag cycle, which is 7 years, and I think that's the very proof of the, in a sense, of the redistribution of just grabbing it and taking it, versus the creator of going in and saying, what is the solution actually, and then creating more of that.
Right.
And the other side of this, so John Paul said, don't measure people with money, and they said, well, okay, then what is a better measurement? Like, you can't say this is a bad measurement and not have a better idea. And he says, well, I have a better idea. And he says, to be poor is the state of being excluded from networks of productivity and exchange.
Right.
Because networks of productivity and exchange is what gives you the opportunity to create value,
right,
and therefore money. Right? And so in there, think about this if you listen to this at home. Think about this. If you want to help a poorer person, somebody who's poorer than you, integrate them into your networks,
yes,
of productivity and exchange. Now, the next question is, well, what is my network of productivity? Well, that's a good question. I want you to think about it. This is an open question. It's like asked by a philosopher, right? An open question. Show me your networks of productivity. Well, what kind of thing makes you more productive? What kind of thing, what kind of network that you're plugged in? Could actually be the internet, could be the cell phone, but it could also be your alma mater. It could be your friends where you call and say, hey, I need a favor. I need to talk to this guy. These are network of productivity. integrate your friends into that network. What is a product? What is a network of exchange? Well, a network of exchange is a bank. It's the financial network. It's access to a market, a stock market. It's access to a physical market, to a distribution network, and things like that. So if you want to say, how do I help somebody who's poorer, how can you give them access to your marketplace? Not a separate marketplace, right. Your marketplace. Let's talk about how many people who want to help with poverty have a 401k where there's no access to it, for no investment in it into poorer areas, that they grow, that your investment dollars, where you give them access to your network of productivity, you're not investing in. I'm not even saying you have to invest in Africa or South America or something, but invest in companies right. that are in states or in businesses that aren't just the big business states or aren't just finance and software, but real Main Street companies. Why don't you put money into that? If you want to help, put money into that. And not. Right. And we're not talking about the superfluous money,
yep.
the tithing or so. I'm talking about your everything, your everyday investment that we, in that sense, vote with our feet, with our wallet. John Paul says that if we do this, we change the face of the world. Just if Catholics start to do this, to integrate the poor into these networks, you change the world.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. And that's precisely why, you know, people like Michael Novak, right? He would speak about how business is primarily a moral enterprise first.
Yeah.
And it's not, so it's, he agrees that there's profit, but he says it's not about the profit. It's about the service of the people, like you mentioned, these structures.
The thing with the profit, let me just, I do this spiel with my students in the room where I pick on somebody and say, Marcus, how's your white blood cell count today? Have you checked yet? No? Why not?
I don't
Marcus,
think I'm checking.
Do you know what happens if you don't have white blood cells? What? Wait, give me a guess. Give me a guess.
If, I'm susceptible to infections.
And then? What's the worst?
A common cold could kill me.
Basically, you're not checking on something that could make you die
right.
in a short period of time.
Right, right, right.
How can you live with yourself not checking white blood cells every day? Let me tell you what the answer is. The answer is that you didn't check your white blood cells because white blood cells are there if you drink water, move, have a healthy diet, sleep. It's a normal product of your body that it produces. But the thing is, you don't actually control it directly.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do what you're meant to do, it's a natural product.
Right.
Right? That is what profit is to a business. I've run many businesses. I don't sit around, and I've tried it a couple of times to say, make profit, make profit, make profit. It doesn't work. It's not. You don't control it directly. It's literally like what white blood cells. Do a good product, do a good campaign or something, and then the product, the profit is a in a sense, a derivative of this. But I'm telling you, the profit has to be there. It's a non-negotiable. If I don't have profit in my company, the company will die.
Yep.
Just like your body with white blood cells. But as little meaning in life as white blood cells give to you during a normal day, profit gives to me running a business,
right.
the moral or the real meaning in my life to run that company.
Right.
It's a very good analogy. It's a very good comparison.
Right.
And I find that people don't understand this until they've run a business themselves. And that's why every one of my students has to start a business, because they won't believe me if they haven't experienced it.
That's right. And that amazing program that you and Rebecca run in Catholic University of America, Business as a Vocation. And I want to draw back then to Santissimus Annus, the wisdom of someone whom you consider your spiritual father. He again reminds us that business is not about a profit.
Yeah.
It's about the service and the flourishing of the human person. So for everyone listening right now, we've become so utilitarian. It's in the water we drink.
Yeah.
We need to rethink how we think about industry, work, and even our work of welfare and philanthropy.
Yeah. And it's not. I want to be clear. I'm not saying white blood cells are not important.
Oh,
it's
yes,
just
it
they're
is.
Not giving the meaning. A company still dies if it's not profitable, because then you have, if it's not profitable, you have not invested the resources effectively. God is a God of abundance. If you imitate God with your company, God has never created anything that isn't profitable. Look at the world. It's a world of abundance. It's summertime now. You see everything flourishing and growing and everything, and we need to do the same. But on a deeper level, our work is our opportunity to imitate and become more like God. Uh-huh. Not with the outcome, but with the process. That's why I think that John Paul pointed to it so much and said, this is truly one of the strong opportunities, big opportunities. Think of how many hours a day we do work. And I don't just mean remunerative work, but somebody taking care of their spouse or right. their parents and taking care of children. This is truly God's work and truly the continuation of creation. And you are sort of hand in hand with God doing this work. He sustains you doing this work. And as you're doing it, pay attention to it, that you can grow ever more closer to God, be like God. You can actually be sure that if you're stepping on this path, that it is the path. It is the path to holiness. And John Paul just works, has so beautiful, such beautiful work. Look up some of his speeches always about Joseph the worker on the yeah. feast. He would have these homilies about work. And he knows because he did labor, you know, he worked in a quarry, he worked in all kinds of areas, and he knows even what hard physical labor is, and he helps us to reframe that from the merely physical to include the spiritual, which is highly rewarding.
My guest has been Andreas Widmer, director of the Art and College Yoga Center for Principal Entrepreneurship at the Catholic University of America. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.